The most important thing. It was a Saturday. The summer sun was shining, the lawnmowers were humming, and the bacon was frying. It was all I could smell. I heard my grandfather's flip-flops shuffling against the worn linoleum floor in the kitchen. He was too cheap to replace it. But he was letting me sleep in, which was odd, considering he got us up at the crack of dawn for chores or to polish his golf clubs before he went out to the range, now that we were all working age. 13, the same age he told us he'd left home and went picking potatoes in Prince Edward Island. I heard Jerry sobbing through the wall between our bedrooms. It wasn't his usual annoying crying. He sounded like a gentle whale plumbing the depths of some uncharted region of the Pacific, calling for a distant herd. I sat up in bed and listened as he went on for what seemed like a million years. I knew something must be wrong and wanted to hug him right through the drywall, but I dared not leave my room. I didn't want to get in trouble or find out that someone had died. I heard Yorkie pawing at the door. I opened it. He held his head low, like he'd done something bad, and his tail wasn't wagging. "What is it, boy?" I asked him. "What's going on?" I rustled the top of his head, and the back of his tail raised to quarter-mast and batted back and forth.
"Jesus Christ,"
Grandpa said after it sounded like he dropped a plate. Yorkie bolted. Jerry continued to cry. I decided to go down and find out what was going on. I hadn't heard a peep from Grandma and wondered where she was. When I entered the kitchen, Grandpa was clattering through forks and knives in one of the drawers and swearing.
"Do you want some goddamn eggs?"
he barked. "Sure," I waited, staring at him. He grabbed a fork and tried to stab out a few pieces of bacon, but he fumbled and the fork fell over the edge of the skillet onto the floor. A strip of bacon teetered on the drawer next to the stove.
"Fuck,"
he muttered and wiped the stove with a paper towel. "Sit down, boy." He tossed my breakfast plate on the table and pulled my chair up all in one motion. He looked frail almost, in a way I'd never seen before. To me, he was invincible, with his strong, hairy arms and barrel chest. But now he was as he really was, an older, graying man. "I've already told your brothers, and I don't like beating around the bush, so listen up." He reached over and rubbed my arm. He never touched me like that before. "Your dad was never in the hospital," he said. "He got in trouble robbing some stores, went to jail. When the police found you, you lot were starving and dirty." He tapped his finger against the table like a tiny hammer trying to beat back the past. "Once we heard what went down, me and Grandma went and got you. Sonny got out and was supposed to come home, but..." Grandpa's voice trailed off for a moment. "I guess he loved drugs and booze more, fucking asshole." He slammed his fist on the table, and his plate fired beans into the air. "Family is the most important thing, Jesse. If I ever catch you doing drugs, I'll disown you." His face looked harder than I'd ever seen before. Like steel, tungsten even. I trembled. Tears began rolling down my cheeks, like an ancient levee had broken. He pulled his hand off my arm. "None of that," he said. "Men don't cry. You're a man now." The smell of margarine filled the air as my grandfather slathered his brown square of toast with it and ate it, and I tried not to cry. Then I heard the sound of my grandmother's rocking chair in the next room, moving back and forth, and the sound of her crying. Canada geese. "There's one right over near the portable," Leroy said, as he reached down for a juicy butt. His black and white Motley Crue concert t-shirt, a hand-me-down from his sister, was skin tight against his back. It looked like it burst open as he bent over to grab the smoke. Even tighter were his acid-washed jeans, which were rolled up and pinned at the bottom to accentuate his kicks, their tongues hanging out like overgrown dog ears. He looked like Sylvia's rocker friends, but without any style. I didn't have the wicked threads he did. We wore Bargain Herald's crap Grandma purchased from the sales bin. Black turtlenecks were about as fashionable as I got, and the one I was wearing was covered in mustard from the lunchroom. "Holy cow," I said, trying to rub the stain off. "That hasn't even been smoked." Leroy held the cigarette up to the sun. The body of it was near perfect. It was just a little crooked. It had yellow moisture stains, but the Export A logo was intact. Leroy pulled a book of matches out of his jeans pocket and dangled them. "Look what I got," he whispered, looking back and forth for Mrs. W. or Mr. G. They were always on patrol and gave any kids they saw hanging around a tough time. We knew we could end up incarcerated in the principal's office. "I stole them from Sylvia this morning," Leroy grinned. He peeled open the book of matches to reveal three perfect rows. The cigarette drooped from his lips and begged for a flame. I huddled close to guard against the wind. The ember burned cherry red as he struck the match, lit the butt, and hauled in a breath. He strained to hold the smoke in, and his face turned green. He exhaled and coughed so loud it sounded like a flock of Canada geese erupting from his lungs. "Here, your turn," he said, still convulsing. I grabbed the smoke and pictured my grandma and grandpa yelling at me. I took a big drag and pretended to blow smoke at them. I didn't cough like Leroy, though. I wheezed, dropped the smoke, and fell ass backwards onto the ground. I groped the grass. Everything was spinning. I saw black spots dance across the blue sky. Leroy laughed, a sound that pulled me back into this world. "You suck." He reached over, plucked the smoke off the gravel where I dropped it, took another drag, and handed it back. "Just ease into it, Jess, like me." He exhaled without coughing, then crossed his arms, oozing style. I wanted to be as cool as him. Cheese slices. "Who the hell has been in the fridge again?" Grandma hollered. "We aren't rich. You boys know that, right? You'll eat us out of house and home." I looked towards the kitchen from the Chesterfield and my TV program. I heard Grandma slam the fridge door and an avalanche of something hitting the floor. All I could see was her hair wagging in the morning light and the dog's ass bounding up the stairs. Yorkie was never one to miss the prospect of spilled food. "I don't know," I said, shrugging. "I swear, Grandma, wasn't me." "The goddamn cranberry juice is nearly gone, too. I told you boys that's for Grandpa's gout." She held up a bunch of empty cheese wrappers, a near-empty package of hot dogs, and a three-quarters empty bottle. The remaining red liquid sloshed around, angry. "I wonder how she slammed the fridge door," I thought, "with her foot?" "I don't know what to do with you boys anymore." She dropped what she was holding and took a drag of her cigarette, smoke licking around her flustered face. I could tell she was trying to remain calm. "Go get your brothers, Jesse." "Okay, Grandma," I said, with a feeling of dread, even though she sounded defeated, not angry anymore. Kind of like everyone in our house since learning the truth about Dad. She nodded and began picking stuff off the floor. My brothers were wrestling in the backyard, Josh beating the shit out of Jerry, like usual. He had Jerry's head in the full Nelson, pressing it forward into his collarbone, choking him almost unconscious. It was his signature move. I knew from experience it was impossible to escape. "Grandma's pissed," I said, trying to catch my breath. Josh let go of Jerry, who fell to the ground, clutching his neck, the pinkish color of life replacing the purple-blue of suffocation. "What's she on about now?" Josh asked. "What does it matter?" Jerry shot back as he got to his feet and made his way to the house. "The dog probably shit inside because we didn't walk him. That's your fault. You were supposed to walk him this morning." I bit my nail. "It's more serious than that." Grandma was sitting on the edge of my grandfather's chair in the living room. On the coffee table were the empty cheese wrappers, a stack of around 20. Small price tags were taped to the table right next to them. See? Grandma began as the three of us walked in, her nicotine-stained index finger pressing down so hard on one of the price tags, her fingertip was white. The wieners here, they cost $2. I buy the good beef kind for your grandfather. He deserves them. She flicked her butt, the ash tumbling into a puke-yellow glass ashtray. The cheese, she motioned to the cloudy wrappers, that's around $3.50. Black diamond cheddar, again, only the best for your grandfather. The cherry on her cigarette hissed as she took another drag and moved on to the final exhibit. And this here, that's cranberry juice, real cranberry juice. The doctor told me to buy it to help with your grandfather's gout. He gets it in the knee and big toe and can't work a day without a glass. That costs $5. Together, it all costs $10.50. And I just bought it yesterday. It should have lasted until next Friday when I do my groceries again. A boa constrictor wrapped tight around my ribs. Jerry rubbed his palms down the front of his jeans. But it's gone. Now what am I going to give him? Wasn't me, Josh blurted out, shaking like a chihuahua with hypothermia as he pushed the bottle towards Jerry. Wasn't me either, Grandma, Jerry said. I swear. He kept it together but looked guilty as sin. He shoved the bottle at me, not knowing I had already been interrogated. Jesse already said it wasn't him either, Grandma said as she tapped the bottle. The tiny echo boomed in my eardrums. So I guess you're all lying again? Her sigh seemed to drain the life out of her. You boys steal food and lie all the time. This time is no different than the thousands of times before. You came to us like that, broken. But now, for once, I want a straight answer. Please tell me the truth. Who did this? We looked at each other, shrugging and making faces like idiots. Grandma didn't budge. Silence hung heavy around us, resting somewhere between her polyester slacks and the wads of black diamond cheese that lay digesting in one of our guts. A smatter of rain misted the sliding doors while we waited for someone to give. Gradually, it turned into a light patter as the wind picked up. I saw a crow perched on the fence looking in at us. I can't take it anymore, Grandma finally said, her voice thin and monotone behind a lungful of cigarette smoke. I want you each to go to your rooms, pack one bag of clothes, and bring it downstairs. I'm taking you to the Children's Aid Society. Your grandfather and I have spoken about this already, and we've tried our best. Josh's mouth dropped open. Jerry's eyes were wider than Josh's mouth. Me? I felt nothing. Or what I can only describe as a yawning chasm of hate. The first time I'd felt it. Make sure to take your boots and winter hats. You'll need them. You're old enough now to survive. Go on, get ready. She shooed us off. Haven't got all day. A flash of black caught my eye. The crow had flown off. I went to my room and began packing. I couldn't stop thinking about being hungry when we were kids with my dad. That gnawing ache that haunted me every day, that made me always think we were on the brink of starving, even when we got to my grandparents with their full fridge. I could actually feel that ache in my legs. Jerry, I knew, felt that hunger most. He told me how he always felt like he could never get enough food, even when he was full. It was a force that drove us to steal and lie, to eat until we destroyed every hors d'oeuvre plate at every family function my grandparents took us to. My cousins used to tease us about how we consumed everything in sight. They called us pigs, but it was something we had no control over. I kept thinking about that hunger as I pulled out my favorite red sweater, my Batman t-shirts, my Blue Jays baseball cap, and four of my favorite jeans from my drawers. I packed them carefully in my Adidas bag, making sure to place pictures of my grandma and grandpa between the layers. I always wished I'd had pictures of my dad to remember him by and didn't want to forget my grandparents wherever I was going. I also grabbed the old, worn-out Polaroid I had of my mom from off the dresser. one of her wearing a Russian-style fox fur hat, and put it in my back pocket for safekeeping, then made my way down to the front door. Jerry and Josh were there, bags packed, stone-faced. Yorkie was there, too, whining and turning in circles, tail wagging faster than normal. Grandma was upstairs, we assumed, searching the change drawer for taxi fare, slamming things. We didn't wait for her to walk us out. We shut the door and left. The brass knocker clanged rudely behind us. Good riddance, we thought. Before we hit the end of the driveway, we linked arms and decided to keep going as far as we could, to find homes where we could eat whatever we wanted, where we didn't have to be afraid anymore. Jerry pulled a butter tart out of the side of his suitcase. We had enough to get us where we were going. We made it as far as the other side of the mall where Grandma did her shopping, about 5 kilometers. We sat near a bush and ate the lone butter tart. As night set in, we got cold and hungry and decided to make our way back home. Jerry and I waited outside the house with our bags while Josh went inside to take the heat for the missing food and for running away. Drive. One day I asked my Uncle Ron where Dad went. I'm sorry, Jess, he said. I miss him too, but we don't know. According to our family, Uncle Ron was the toughest of my uncles. He was like a pro wrestler, stout through the middle, the bridge of his nose was thick, and he had a gold tooth that glinted every time he talked. His body looked like he'd been attacked by wild animals. There were deep gashes, burns, and knife marks all over. The scars on his knees were the deepest, from a shark attack back in the 70s, he said. Grandma said they're from when he'd broken his legs at work, and from when his friend ran him over with a car. He told me stories about my father, and how they'd get into trouble on the golf course they both worked at as caddies, or fighting, or fight with the neighborhood boys, or chase girls and terrorize their boyfriends with firecrackers. I even blew up your grandfather's garage playing with gasoline, he said, adding that Grandpa laid the smack down so hard for that, Ron saw stars for several weeks. Grandpa and Uncle Ron had a strange relationship. Grandpa tried to keep him out of the house, but always let him back in, I think, because he loved him. There were times that Uncle Ron went to jail for months. When he came home, Grandma always hugged him and made him a big meal, and everyone was happy and joking. But when Grandpa got home and saw him, he gave him a tough time. Everyone was silent. Uncle Ron just smiled and didn't say anything. I thought it strange he would allow himself to be treated that way, but I understood why he never quipped off to Grandpa. Respect was important in our home. When me and my brothers first arrived at our grandparents, it was Uncle Ron who greeted us and made us feel at home. There was something about him. Dogs and kids loved him, but everyone else was scared. My older cousins were terrified of him. They fetched him beers and cigarettes whenever he was around. He'd just motion to the cooler or a pack and they'd run. But I loved him. He lived around the corner from us, and he'd come and put me on his shoulders, take me to the park, and swing me on a swing until I laughed so hard I got dizzy. He was a father to me in many ways. Come on, Jess, Uncle Ron said, punching his cinder block fist into my shoulder and bringing me back to the moment. You want to come on a delivery downtown tonight? I got to see a few people on Young Street. It'll be fun. He was a flower delivery man and good at his job. He collected money and no one was ever late on a payment. He'd pull up and men would run into the shops and come out with wads of money. His gold tooth glimmered between his lips, inviting me to join him. I guess. I twisted my foot on the ground as if putting out a cigarette, trying to decide if I wanted to feel sorry for myself in my room or go out and cheer up. You don't have to look so morose, you know. He punched my arm again. I struggled to smile through the pain. I'll be here at 4. Be ready or else. He winked. When he screeched into the driveway that afternoon in a red convertible Mustang, I was waiting on the balcony. I had no idea where he'd gotten his new ride, but it was nicer than the beat-up work van he usually drove. I had on a white muscle shirt and a jean jacket with the sleeves ripped off. I thought the frayed strands that dangled over my shoulders made me look tough, like one of the characters from The Outsiders. Like Uncle Ron. My fake Ray-Bans added to my persona. "Get a load of those pipes," Uncle Ron said. I knew he wasn't making fun of my arms. He was trying to make me feel confident. A field of zits covered the whole of my face, and my arms and legs looked like stretched hot dogs as I shot up nearly a foot in the past few months. I put on my best bodybuilder pose, curling my fists and biceps inward as hard as I could. It felt good. "You'll get there, kid," he said as he stood up in the driver's seat and returned my flex with his own double guns. "Just gotta start lifting." His arms looked like Hulk Hogan's as he rotated his head and kissed the bicep crest of each arm. They were bigger whenever he returned from jail. "Now let's ride," he hollered as he sat down, tooted the horn twice, and combed back his hair, looking in the rear view as if he were a 1950s greaser. "We haven't got all day, Schwarzenegger." I launched myself off the balcony, down 10 feet, hopped over the passenger door, and we were off. A mix of Fog Hat, Deep Purple, and Steppenwolf blasted out of the car speakers as we drove, announcing to the world that two badasses were in the vicinity. The wind blew through my hair as Uncle Ron drummed on the steering wheel, reminding me of my dad. When we got downtown, people gawked as we went by. I got excited when I saw women looking at us, but they weren't checking me out. Uncle Ron, I knew, caught all the eyes. "You see that, Jess?" he said as he smiled back at a blonde woman coming out of a store. "It's all in how confident you are." He flexed his left arm, twirled a toothpick between his front teeth, then held it erect in the sunlight. I rolled my eyes. "Just try it," he said. "Be the rooster." He bobbed his head back and forth to the beat of the music. "What does that even mean?" I asked, adjusting my vest. "You know, cock of the walk, own it, feel the music, like this." He curled his lip up, revealing his gold tooth. It reminded me of a jailhouse Elvis. I tried bobbing my head and smiling at the ladies on the sidewalk, just like he told me to, but I knew I was more like a malnourished chicken, and every girl I grooved at stared right through me over to Uncle Ron and his muscles. He laughed. "Just give it time, kid. It gets easier, I promise." I laughed back. I was glad to be hanging out with my favorite uncle, making him happy, the sun beaming down on my face. We stopped in all the cool spots to collect money, eat ice cream and French fries, and listen to street performers. The men we stopped to talk to, though, were terrified, just like my cousins. I'd see the look of relief on their faces in the side mirror as we pulled away. I'd heard that my dad and Ron were in business together years ago and wondered if it was delivering flowers. Uncle Ron also introduced me to other guys, his friends, as Sonny's boy, and they all looked like Uncle Ron, muscle-bound and tough, and all of them were super excited to meet me. They had scars and tattoos and toothpicks, and they talked about my dad like he was a legend. The stories washed over me. Not one person had a bad word to say about him, not like Grandpa. It was nice to hear. I had never been proud to be my father's son before. On our way out of one of the shops on Young Street, we came across a guy bumming change in front of Sam the Record Man. He was thin and looked much older than Uncle Ron, with long, greasy hair and a matted gray and brown beard. In front of him were a woolen blanket, a few plastic bags, and a paper coffee cup. Not many people ventured near him, veering close to the storefronts instead and turning their heads. I was compelled to do the same. Uncle Ron, though, walked right up to him and put 20 in his cup. The man smiled a toothy smile and said thank you, but Uncle Ron just stared at him. The man looked at him, then over at me, I could tell he was trying to assess what was going on, but then Uncle Ron said, "Don't mention it, brother." Before we rounded the corner to where we were parked, Uncle Ron turned back, but the homeless man was gone. "I always think," he said, "that it could be Sunny." Birdsong. Mrs. R., the French teacher, walked up to my desk and handed back my report card with its proof of signature. She peered over her glasses at the report card and me and said, "We need to talk after class." I could have sworn a black cloud hung low around her calf muscles and knee-length skirt as she turned and walked back toward the front of the class. She was stern, powerful, and in control, and the clump of her high heels thundered through my brain. Whispers from my classmates came from all directions. My friend Renee, who sometimes helped me when I didn't understand things, turned around and mouthed, "You're dead meat, Thistle." I gulped. Mrs. R. wasn't to be trifled with. She screamed in our faces if we did something wrong. In the worst cases, she'd get so mad that she'd cry yell and make you do consecutive detention for a couple of weeks. I glanced down at my grade, 35%, a big, fat F. Worse than F, more like K. The comment beside it read, "Jesse is frequently unprepared for class. A more consistent effort is required, bleak and brutal." I was 2/3 of the way through the year, and I was sure to fail at this rate. Aside from taking away our hard-won Nintendo and go-kart and grounding me, I knew Grandpa would whip me so hard I wouldn't be able to sit straight. Like the way he lashed Josh with the red rod, an unbreakable half-inch fiberglass golf flagpole, when Josh had thrown that rock in the park and it ricocheted off the fence and broke that Sikh man's window. It wasn't Josh's fault. I was there. The rock simply bounced, redirected itself off the fence post, then smash. But it didn't matter. The window was shattered. It cost Grandpa $200 to fix it, and Josh had to be punished. The stripes Grandpa tore off his backside were purple and puffy, and Josh had to lie on his side while they healed, but they still left stripe-like welts. He looked like a zebra. Grandpa's anger that day wasn't usual. It was the same rage I saw when he warned me about doing drugs after he told me about Dad's disappearance, and it scared me so much that I bawled in my room as Josh received the beating of his life. I lay on my bed and covered my ears with my pillow to hide from the sound of the rod thrashing through the air. In my head, I begged for Josh to cry out, but he kept it together somehow. I knew it was to show he was a man, the way Grandpa liked. But that only made things worse. After what sounded like 30 more blows, Josh finally bellowed out in agony. It was a sound so sad, it penetrated right to where I was hiding, right through the concrete foundation of our house. Grandma once told me that Grandpa was that way with discipline because his pappy was that way with him, and that he got it even worse than us. Grandpa was only 5 when his father died from a heart attack in 1938, and he had to move 200 kilometers out to the sticks of Cape Breton to live with Pappy. There he worked hauling wood, picking rocks, and fishing on the dory like a grown man. He never got to have a childhood like us. I always wondered if that was why Grandpa took us in, because he knew what it was like to have no one, to lose his family. Whatever the reasons for the way Grandpa was, the scream Josh let out that day sounded like he was being killed, and I always questioned how Grandpa's childhood beatings could have been much worse. Mrs. R. wrapped the blackboard with her pointer and trained her eyes on me. "Some students," she cleared her throat, "didn't come with a report card proof signed by their parents. I've already spoken with most of you, but I'll see those of you who didn't after class." "After class?" I started to chew my thumbnail. I spit a bit out and it landed in the hair of the girl who sat ahead of me, but she didn't notice. The clock's hands seemed to beat forward with incredible speed, and each tick sounded like an explosion. Tick. I only had 4 minutes until the bell rang, and I'd have to answer for what I'd done. Tick. I stared at the French vocabulary signs that adorned the room, searching for a way out. The stupid French toad with the à bientôt word bubble above its head. The picture of that annoying little girl waving au revoir to nobody. The huge picture of those bright, obnoxious daffodils that scream Le Printemps. I imagine them all piled on a bonfire, with Mrs. R.'s head roasting on a stick. Tick! The minute hand surged forward, 2 minutes left, reminding me that I was trapped. Shit! I knew why Mrs. R. had singled me out. It was in the way she looked at me after she'd peered down at my grandmother's signature and handed me back my report card. The edges of my grandmother's name were shaky and didn't flow right. When I received my grades before the Christmas break and saw my F, I panicked. I couldn't let my grandparents see how poorly I was doing. It didn't take much to set Grandpa off these days. I didn't want to end up like Josh. I told Leroy on our walk home, and he told me about a guy in one of his classes who'd forged his parents' signature on a report card and gotten away with it. The idea sounded plausible, genius even. So I went home and traced over an existing signature Grandma had written on a permission slip for a field trip I'd taken in another class. The signatures all looked great, but then I messed up. I only had one report card, one shot, and I failed miserably. When I handed the report card in, I'd done it quickly, tossing it on Mrs. R.'s desk underneath everyone else's report cards, hoping that she'd be lazy and would just hand them in that way. But she didn't. She checked each one and discovered my crime, and now I had to pay for it. Ring, ring, ring. The bell went off. What the hell happened to the time? As I lurched towards Mrs. R., I straightened my cardigan and kept my eyes down. I somehow thought that if I didn't look at her, I could still hide and maybe everything would be okay. She ushered the class out and paused before shutting the door and asking me to sit in the seat adjacent to her desk. It was known as the hot seat. "I taught your brothers," she said. "They were good students, Josh especially." She took the forged document from my hand and fingered my sloppy fraud. "I've seen a lot of faked signatures over the years, but this one has to be the worst." Her words were like weights dragging me to the bottom of the ocean. "You know, I have to report you to the principal. He'll contact your grandparents." I expected her to yell, like she always did, cry yell even, but she didn't. She just kept looking at me. I started squirming. "This is a very poor start to life. Fraud is a real crime," she continued. "Why did you do this?" I thought of Josh and the punishments we got. I couldn't breathe. You don't know how it is," I said. "You don't know how it is for me." I began to sob. "How what is?" I rocked in my chair. "I can't go home with a report card like this. You don't know what will happen." I couldn't feel my face, but was crying. "It's not his fault. He was raised that way." Mrs. R. didn't say anything, just sat there, rubbing my back. I couldn't hear the clock anymore, just Mrs. R.'s soft breath and the sound of a robin singing outside. Jack him. "Fuck family ties," I growled and changed the channel. I couldn't stand to see Michael J. Fox get hugged by a stupid-looking bearded father after he'd apologized for taking speed and redeemed himself. If I got caught with even a cigarette, I'd be practically tarred, feathered, beaten, and grounded for a year. "Dude," Leroy cried, "now we'll never know what happened. Put it back on. It's bullshit. Bloody Alex P. Keaton." I flicked through a few stations, then launched the remote across the room. Bits of brown and green plastic exploded all over the concrete floor. Leroy let out a goonish laugh, the kind of sound we made when either of us started shit. I didn't care that my grandparents would be upset. Fuck them, too. I thought. I'll just blame it on Jerry. Putting it on my brother was a diversion strategy that worked most times. He was a horrible liar. So bad, in fact, that when other people did stuff, stuff he was totally innocent of, and he tried explaining to my grandparents what happened, he looked guilty just talking. The poor bastard had taken so many of my thrashings, I'd lost count. "We could drink some beer," I half asked, half offered. I walked over and opened the fridge, but saw tumbleweeds. Leroy searched the empties. Nothing there either. Black and white static on the TV rolled and buzzed like a hive of angry bees. The set was stuck on Channel 81, the late-night Saturday night porn station, and even if we could hear what was going on, we'd be lucky to see a nipple. It made it difficult to masturbate, chasing phantom nipples. I pulled out my pocket knife, stuck it in the broken rotary dial on the left of the screen, and jiggled it. The vice grips we usually used were gone, taken by Josh, no doubt, in one of his fits of backyard engineering, and my little Swiss Army knife wasn't strong enough. I pulled the plug on the TV with a grunt. "I think I'm going to go home," Leroy said, rubbing his stomach beneath his Maple Leafs jersey. It was hours past dinner time, and we both hadn't eaten. Grandma made fish cakes earlier, but neither of us liked them, so we passed on our offer. It was the only meal I could say no to. I hated the huge raw onions packed into the patties. When I was around 5, my grandparents caught me one night after I'd stuffed my cheeks until I looked like Dizzy Gillespie and excused myself from the dinner table repeatedly. I was spitting my cargo in the toilet. Grandpa thought it was clever of me, his little puking chipmunk. Grandma wasn't as impressed. They tried to force me to eat them over the years, but I never did. "Okay, I'll walk you over." I put my shoes on. The smell of fish and oil spilled onto the street as we left. The night air was cool for September. Streetlights flickered in the park, surrounded by a blanket of darkness. I kicked a pop can and it rolled over a storm grate and stood motionless at the base of the curb. Leroy kicked it, sending it up across the boulevard and onto the sidewalk. As we rounded the corner, we saw Ivan, a blonde Polish kid about 4 years younger than us, who lived 10 houses down from Leroy, playing on his front lawn. I thought it was strange that he'd be out at this hour all by himself. To us, he was spoiled beyond belief. He had toys galore, and I often saw him at the convenience store with his dad buying chips and gum and whatever else his little heart desired. His dad usually gave him the leftover change, and sometimes he'd share with me if I was hanging around with my friends. It was hard to see him with his dad, all happy and eating candy, holding hands, and playing hockey together out in front of his house every Saturday. Grandpa never did anything like that with me. "You thinking what I'm thinking?" I asked as I turned to Leroy. "What? No!" The expression on Leroy's face told me he knew exactly what I was thinking. "That's too much, even for us." I stopped in the middle of the street and grabbed his arm. "The kid is loaded. We can jack his money and run away. It's dark. He won't know what hit him." My Swiss Army knife burned in my back pocket, begging me to take control of this situation, to follow through so for once I'd have some goddamn lunch money and could buy my own goddamn fries. "Don't be crazy." Leroy ripped his arm away. "I live right down the street. I can't." He stood his ground. He wasn't going to cross the line. Not now, not tonight, not on his street. Just then, Ivan stood up at the end of his lawn and waved over at us. "Leroy's right. I'd get caught, somehow. Like everyone gets caught on all the police shows. No one gets away." "See?" Leroy said with a look of relief, knowing I was backing down. "That's the Jesse I know. Just chill." He smiled at Ivan. We'd gotten into lots of trouble before, and Leroy had never put his foot down about anything, but here he was chickening out and telling me what to do. I was humiliated. My knife weighed down the back pocket of my jeans, and I put my hand over it to hide its imprint from the night sky. Leroy walked backward towards his house and told me he'd see me in the morning on our walk to school. Then he went inside. I was out there alone with Ivan and my knife. Without a thought, I walked over to him, thrust my knife in his face, and robbed him. He cried for his dad, then ran into his house when I let go of him. I fled into the dark, holding the change I'd ripped from his pockets. I was in shock at what I'd done. I wondered if my grandfather would forgive me, like fathers did with their sons on TV. A new family. The night before Christmas Eve, Grandma surprised us. "Your mother moved from Saskatoon to Ottawa," she said. "She's coming to see you tomorrow." Grandpa grunted and slammed back his chicken and potatoes, barely looking at anyone. Josh, Jerry, and I excused ourselves from the dinner table and retreated to our rooms. It was the first time we'd all left food on our plates before. I wondered if Mom would still look as beautiful as she did the last time I'd seen her, and I couldn't sleep that night waiting for her. I stared out my window looking at the stars, trying to think of the right words to say, but they all jumbled together. I pictured her laughing face on the surface of the moon, the light of it dimming with each passing cloud. My throat closed as I tried to swallow. I finally got up and pulled my best chip and pepper t-shirt, my nicest black slacks, and my penny loafers from out of my closet. I laid all of them on the floor in front of my bed, methodically picked lint off both garments, then applied shoe polish to the loafers until they shined like mirrors. I tried to figure out how I'd comb my hair, down the middle, spiked up, or off to the side. I couldn't decide. I wanted to look good, to show Mom how much I'd grown. From across the hall, the deep rumbles of my grandfather's snores were followed by the squeaky squirrel noises Grandma made to wake him up and keep him from suffocating to death from the sleep apnea he had. They weren't conferencing about me for once, and that made me happy. Often, at night, I could hear them talking about me, even though their voices were hushed, as though I was in a different kind of trouble than usual. "Perhaps they know about the things I've done," I'd worried. "Perhaps they're going to take me to the Children's Aid Society after all." Finally, morning hit and Yorkie's bark announced Mom's arrival. I ran downstairs as fast as I could, hair gelled to one side, and flung the door open so hard the door handle punched a hole in the wood paneling. Yorkie was running around in circles behind me. "Hi, Jesse!" Mom shouted with a huge beaming smile, her arms stretched out. She was wearing the Russian hat from my picture tilted to the side. The cold December air froze puffs of breath around her head so they looked like smoke caught amongst the fox fur. Her hair was shorter and browner now, not the black flowy locks I remembered, but she still looked the same to me. Beside her were two gym bags and a little coal-haired boy, around 6 years old. Mom looked towards a man rummaging in a gray car across the street who waved over to us. Then she turned back to me, waiting for her hug. I had a sudden urge to go and hide in the boot box. The little boy tugged at Mom's leg. "Hug her, you idiot," I could hear Josh say from behind me. His words snapped me out of my daze. He pushed me aside and embraced Mom. I fell against the wall, my hand finding purchase in the newly created hole. Deep growls of joy emanated from Josh and Mom, warming me somewhat. Josh rubbed the boy's head and introduced himself. The boy said his name was Daniel. "He's your little brother," Mom said. A surge of jealousy ran cold up my spine. Jerry trailed along the hallway leading to the door. Each step was strained and reminded me of when Grandma forced him to walk the dog on Sunday morning. He had a sneer across his face, and his arms were crossed. "I can't find my wallet," the man from the car hollered over to Mom. "I think I left it at the gas station near Kingston." "I have it here in my purse, George," Mom said. "Now get over here and meet my boys." The man nodded and made his way to us, a small skip in his step. Daniel stuck his hand out to shake mine, but I batted it away and stuck my tongue out at him. Mom didn't see. She was focused on George. "That's not nice," the man said as he grabbed their luggage and placed it inside the house beside where we were standing. He's your little brother. My son. His name is Daniel, and mine's George. Nice to meet you. He, too, stuck his hand out. I kept mine down by my side. It may take some time, Mom said to him, as she pushed Daniel and me closer together. We did eventually embrace, but the whole thing seemed wrong. I wanted to bear hug him until he couldn't breathe, crush his ribs, then stomp his tiny head on the driveway right in front of George. Jerry sighed and went back upstairs without saying hello. I figured he was just as upset as me about Daniel. Josh and Yorkie, however, were wagging their arses like fools at their new friends. Fucking traitors, I thought. But I forced myself to be nice to Mom and George and help them in with their stuff. The last time we'd seen Mom was in 1985, when I was 10. She'd bust out by Greyhound from Saskatchewan. It took her 3 days to get to Toronto. When we arrived, I just stood in the doorway clutching a dream catcher I'd made for her at school, my mouth open. She looked exactly like she did in my faded Polaroid. The photograph was yellowed at the corners and curling inwards, but she remained untouched in the center, gracefully standing in front of some snow-peaked mountains. She looked like a real-life Indian in that photo, one from the movies, not like me and my snotty brothers. I ran and hid in the boot box, a giant wooden cabinet Grandpa had made beside the downstairs doors, until he yanked me out to say hello. I couldn't muster a sound, just handed her the dream catcher. She laughed, cried, and hugged me tight, lost for words herself, holding my gift. During her visit, Grandma only let us out of her sight a couple of times. Once when Mom took us to catch a Saturday matinee of The Jungle Book. I thought Grandma was crying as we drove off, but it was hard to tell through the back window of the taxi. The other time was when Grandma went to bed early after dinner one night, and we snuck down to the basement to watch TV with Mom. Grandpa saw us tiptoe past his armchair and waved us downstairs like he was landing a plane. "Go, go," he said with a grin. He had a soft spot for my mom. He told her she was a good person, that none of it was her fault, and that we'd go back to her once we'd grown up and left home. Mom was sitting cross-legged on the couch, reading a comic. She had a stack of them she'd brought with her. Josh and I knelt in front of her while Jerry sat across from us on the wood stove under the window, as silent as ever. "Josh, I want you to have these before I go back home tomorrow morning." She waved her hands at the comics. "Conan's a fighter like you." "Cool!" Josh cried out, his eyes lighting up as he rifled through his hoard of newfound treasure. I strained to imagine my brother wielding a massive broadsword and lopping off the heads of demons like Conan was doing on the cover of the comics in my mom's hand. Conan's muscles rippled, and his shiny black hair made him look like an Indian, like my Uncle Ron, but certainly not like Josh. Josh splayed the comics across the floor and lost himself in them, turning the pages faster than any human eyes could read. "And you, Jerry?" Mom said, remaining on the couch and respecting the distance between them. "I'll always keep the picture you drew for me. I won't ever fold it or lose it or anything, I promise. Will you do the same with the one that I gave you?" The roar of the water heater filled the basement as she waited for an answer. Jerry just shifted his ass around on the stove, then nodded while looking at Josh, freaking out. Mom smiled, then turned to me, and I shifted my knees to get closer to her. "And for you, my little pumpkin head, I have something special." She reached down under her ashtray and handed me a glossy photograph. It was of her. Her hair was wet and sticking out all over the place, and she was lying on a bed holding a baby. "That's your younger brother Daniel," she said. "What?" the three of us asked in unison. "You have a brother," she said as she took a drag of her smoke and leaned in close to point to the baby. "I want you to have this picture of us, Jesse." She looked so happy. "I met a kind man a couple of years ago, and this is our son. I wanted to tell you before I left and waited for the right moment. I fell back, the air sucked out of my lungs, but I managed to squeak something out. I wish I had a sister instead. Mom looked hurt and confused. I knew she was waiting for me to say something more, but Josh spoke first. I think it's wonderful. Now I have 3 younger brothers I can beat up. Mom didn't laugh, nor did Jerry. And I just stared at the picture, wondering how Mom could start over without us, and what Dad would think. After Mom left, Grandma took us to a drugstore. We were told it was for something called the Kids Identification Sign-Up, and that it was because strangers in our city had murdered and killed children our age, and we had to watch out that we weren't stolen from right under our parents' noses. During the fingerprinting and mugshot process, the workers briefed us on child sexual abuse, stranger danger, street proofing, and how to call the police, and we were told that we should memorize where our home was on a map. Grandma gave them our dental and health records, blood types, and known allergies. I didn't understand much of what I was told, or why I had to promise to keep my eyes out for trouble. Trouble that wanted to kill me. I'd never thought about dying or going missing before, and both scenarios scared the shit out of me. After, Grandpa told us it was because Grandma loved us so much and was trying to protect us. From what, I thought. I don't know what I did with that picture Mom gave me. I certainly didn't have it when she, George, and Daniel showed up at our door on Christmas Eve. It was like my memory of it had blacked out. I had a hard time getting used to seeing myself as a middle brother. It meant I was like Goony Jerry all of a sudden, with his middling spot as neither oldest or youngest. No special responsibilities like Josh had as the oldest to take care of business and teach us younger boys about life or protect us. And Jerry didn't get away with stuff like I did as the youngest because I was too small to understand anything. I was now just an invisible middle child like him. The whole time Mom was visiting with Daniel and George, I tried my best to reclaim my status as the baby boy. I acted younger than I was, purposefully messing up my grammar and asking her to cut my meat at dinner like she did with Daniel. She ignored me and Grandma swooped in with her mother cape to do it, ruining the whole thing. I showed Mom a photo of when I was 5 smoking a cigar with Grandpa at the cottage in Nova Scotia. Everyone else loved that photo of us, but she barely glanced at it. I tried to remind her that I was the youngest thistle boy, not Daniel. Daniel was just some latecomer. Turned out he also somehow had our father's name, but he clearly wasn't his son. He was George whatever the fuck's son. It was all to no avail. Daniel was the center of her affection. He was her new baby boy. She let him rest on her lap like an infant in front of everyone. She got him dressed every morning. She made sure he was always with us. I wanted to vomit whenever he was around. Grandpa, though, was nice during their visit. He went out of his way to make them feel at home, even making George and Daniel baked beans and bannock twice. A record considering he'd only ever made those staples of the Cape Breton diet for us 3 times in 10 years. He also made them his special sugar-glazed apples. When I was a boy, molten apples were like golden candy, he said. Everyone lost their minds whenever they got them. If they're so special, I sneered as Grandpa Daniel and George devoured them in front of me in the kitchen. Why don't you stick them up your ass? Grandpa and George even had a few private heart-to-hearts in the living room while watching the Leafs play, and I could tell from my vantage point on the stairs that Grandpa was sizing him up. He watched the way George drank his beers, how fast or slow they went down, and if he requested another once the last was done. Grandpa said you could tell a lot about a man by how fast he drinks, how he holds himself during conversation, how he asks for things, and how firmly he shakes your hand. I was sure George had no idea he was under my grandfather's microscope. Grandma barely spoke with George, Mom, or Daniel. She acted the same way when Mom had come before. just plenty of flybys and quick, probing questions like, what's going on? What are you doing? Why are you here? What do you want? She was like a patrol helicopter looking for a bank robber. Josh told me it was because she was scared. Of what? I don't know. Whenever we were with Mom, Grandma was close by, pacing, silent, breathing heavy. She didn't even read any of her Harlequin novels, which was odd considering she did that obsessively any other time. Josh even found her with her ear up to the wall once, listening to our conversations with Mom. I'm keeping an eye out for mice, she said. We knew that was bullshit, because she kept the house crumb-free and spotless. One day before New Year's, Mom made me my favorite lunch, spaghetti and meatballs, she remembered. Of course I remember, she said, as she placed my plate in front of me. You're my little pumpkin head. I was happy that I still had a special place in her heart. Josh and Jerry were outside playing hockey. Grandma was in the living room. The theme to General Hospital was blasting, and Daniel and George sat across from me watching Mum serve us. There was what sounded like an avalanche of 2x4s outside. Grandpa started swearing. He'd come back from the hardware store with framing wood, and I thought maybe I should be outside helping him. I dug into a meatball, and George spoke. Look here. He pulled out a black-and-white picture of a strange man from his wallet. He had on a black robe with a huge cross draped over his shoulder. He was like Friar Tuck from the Robin Hood cartoon, bald on top, with a long, unkempt beard. There was a severe look about him. I twirled my noodles around my fork and tried to ignore George and the picture. This is Gregory 17, George said. He yanked a similar photo from the other side of his billfold. Mom placed George's lunch in front of him. I think she was trying to get him to keep quiet. He's the real Pope, George went on. I glanced over at the picture. He didn't look like Pope John Paul II to me. A long time ago, George said, the Catholic Church lost its way. It became decadent and stopped following the true way. Mom's left eyelid twitched. That's when Pope Clement XV, the order's first pope, decided to split from Rome and form the Apostles of Infinite Love out in Quebec, about 2 hours from where we live in Ottawa. Daniel sat up straight at his father's words. It's nice there, Daniel said, a noodle hanging out of his mouth. I lived there with the brothers for a few months, he smiled. Grandma stormed into the room, the strong scent of tobacco trailing behind, which was odd because she was out of smokes. She scowled at George and Mom like a mama bear defending her cub. George stuffed his pictures away. Mom smiled. No religion in this house, Grandma barked as she slammed some dishes in the sink. I felt that awesome power in her again, the same as when she got us years before. I didn't know what to make of George or his picture, but it was creepy. Mom, George, and Daniel left later that week. I asked Grandma and Grandpa if Mom was okay. They didn't seem too concerned. But Mom and Daniel kind of disappeared after that. No phone calls or anything. Tradition. This one here looks nice. Try it on. Grandma handed me a preppy white button-up shirt to go with the black slacks she'd pull from the good section of the Hudson's Bay men's department over near the polo clothes. The shirt fit slim around my torso and snug around my neck when she buttoned it up. She turned me to look in the mirror, but before she did, she licked her fingers and slicked my eyebrows into place. Spiffy. Well, look at you. My baby boy all grown up and ready for work. I fixed my collar and stuck my chin up slightly. I knew this was a special occasion because Grandma usually took me to Bargain Herald's or Zeller's, and we'd go to the Skillet restaurant and eat hot dogs in a basket afterwards. Not today, though. I thought of those Skillet hot dogs as I admired myself and said, But Grandma, these pants and shirt are nearly $200. We can't afford that. She wagged her head and scoffed. You better believe we can. When it comes to work, you gotta knock 'em dead. I'd never seen her so excited or generous before, except when it came to Grandpa's work boots and overalls. He always had the best. Even his lunch pail and thermos. Work was important to the Thistles, and Grandma made sure her man looked good and was well-fed when he made our family its money. Grandpa, too, had acted differently since he'd gone across the street a month ago to talk with our neighbor, Mr. Q. He'd come back whistling, Yorkie by his side, and the dog appeared just as gleeful as he did. Good news, Jess, he said with a huge smile. You've got a job. Mr. Q was a manager at the produce department at the grocery store in the biggest mall in town, and Grandpa told me I'd start in a few weeks. You'll be a produce clerk. $3.75 an hour. He walked past me into the house to announce the good news to Grandma, who was watching a soap opera. She gasped with joy. I could actually hear it through the screen door from where I was on the driveway. As I pulled out the lawnmower, she waved to me from the balcony. Like those old pictures of when men went off to war on battleships or trains and their women saw them off. I could feel my face flush, and I flashed a smile at her. I knew it looked weird. Grandpa didn't drink that day, and I caught him singing to himself later in the garage as he organized his bits and bobs for his job on Monday. I examined myself in the mirror. I was now receiving the same treatment as Grandpa, and I smiled. Grandma hiked my pants up, exposing my socks and squaring my nuts in the process. They fit nice, she said, but up around here, around your waist. I don't want to see you with them hanging low around your ass, like you do with your jeans, that god-awful Rab style. I thought I looked like Urkel on Family Matters, and I grimaced but somehow managed to keep my smile. Grandma pivoted, grabbing one paisley and one striped tie from the shelf behind me. I covertly pulled my pants back down. Relief. The ties in Grandma's hand weren't the wide-bottom ones Grandpa wore to the elevator awards once a year that were the worst shades of brown and green, putrid remnants of the 1960s that he refused to replace, the same color as those hippie flowers on the bath tiles in the upstairs bathroom. No, these ties were royal blue and black, thin at the bottom, actually fashionable. Calvin Klein's, she said as she turned them over to show me the labels. She lassoed one around my neck and had it bound up before I could say go, pulling it tight. My eyes bulged in the mirror as she patted my bum. A lady killer you are. Tall, dark, and handsome. I looked at myself in the mirror with doubt. I was tall but lanky as a daddy long legs, and still covered in zits. But I had just started grade 9, and Leroy and I were taking a drama class and, to our surprise, discovered it was filled with beautiful girls who found us funny. And in one of the photography classes I took, a girl named Heather asked to take my headshot. She had a crush on me, or so I'd heard from classmates. Sure, I said, as long as I get a copy. She made a bunch of prints and posted them on the wall near the gym. I saw them when I walked past. By the end of the day, all the girls at school had stolen them. I knew because they'd been waving them at me in class. I couldn't be angry. I was more flattered than anything else. No facial hair, though, Grandma said. She rubbed the back of her hand against my cheek and then pinched it hard. I pulled away, rubbing it with my fingers. Toughen up, sunshine. She waved it off like it was nothing. Native men don't get hair the same as others, she added. Maybe you'll be lucky and never have to shave like me. She hiked up her fuchsia slacks, exposing her leg. It just didn't grow. That's the Algonquin in me. The thought of never shaving upset me for a brief second. I pictured Grandpa dipping his razor in the sink before work every morning. I loved watching him shave when I was small. Sometimes he'd lather up my face and we'd shave together. It was serious business. The silence between us was only broken by our laughter when he slapped on aftershave and screamed from the sting. "Your granddad is as hairy as a Scottish muskox," Grandma said, as though she could sense what I was thinking. "He hates shaving every day." Not wasting time, she wrangled a black leather belt from over by the till and fastened it around my waist. It fit perfectly, its chrome buckle reflecting light into the mirror. I felt like a millionaire. "That's it," Grandma said. "That's your uniform." We stood admiring the ensemble, Grandma holding my shoulders. I loved her so much at that moment. She was a good grandma. I knew that. I leaned over and gave her a big hug. I did look good, in a grown-up kind of way. My new job represented a real step towards adulthood. Most of my friends, like Derek down the street, had only paper routes. But here I was with a real-deal outfit and, soon, a real-deal paycheck. I suddenly felt confident and handsome. When we got to the front desk to pay, Grandma turned to me. "Grandma Clara, my grandmother you met last year that's over 100, her grandpa was a chief factor of the Hudson's Bay Company up on Lake Timiskaming during the fur trade 150 years ago. He ran that fort. Our family built this country, Jesse." The teller scanned the goods, and the total of $374.87 popped up on the register. My heart jumped. Grandma opened her ancient purse and handed over her credit card. "That's why we shop at the Bay. Tradition is important. Remember that." Grandpa was running the van just by the store entrance. He had "El Paso" by Marty Robbins blasting on the radio when we got in, exhaust fumes flooding around us as we buckled in. Grandma promptly blazed up a Du Maurier and sucked in a massive drag. I coughed, waving my hand in front of my face. But I took in what smoke I could. I needed a cigarette myself. Grandpa leaned over into Grandma's cloud of death, peeking inside the bags. "What you got there, little lady?" he asked. "Never you mind, Searle," Grandma snapped. She snatched up the receipt, pushing his hairy paws aside and folding it into the wad of other receipts in her purse. He let out a loud yelp, and they both laughed. "The boy looks like a million bucks." Troublemaker. After word got out that I had a steady job at the grocery store, my stature at school elevated further. I had my own cash to buy pizza and cigarettes at a store across the street during lunch, and soon I made friends with older kids at my school and other high schools across the area. I continued to hang out with my local street buddies, Brian, Derek, Leroy, but my new friends drank and slept with younger girls and went to all the best parties. Some weren't in school at all. They had their own apartments, cars, and jobs. We formed a gang. We called ourselves the Bud Boys because Budweiser was our beer, and we put Bud beer caps on our baseball hats. The caps helped identify who was who when we brawled at parties or in school parking lots. By the middle of grade 10, my grades were plummeting. I was scraping by with 50s and 60s and still couldn't read or write very well. Math was the only grade I was keeping steady, but even that began to sink after I started skipping class all the time. I was branded a brash troublemaker by school authorities after the stereo in the drama class was lifted in a break-in one Friday night. Leroy's long arms didn't have any trouble reaching the window into the classroom. I climbed him like a ladder and tossed out the audio equipment. We took it to a Vietnamese kid who was waiting in a townhouse nearby. His cousin bought it for $200. Leroy and I got $100, and we split that. I was questioned by the police, teacher, and principal, but they didn't have enough evidence to lay any charges. The authorities threatened to expel me if things didn't turn around. But I didn't give a shit. Grandpa didn't seem interested in me anymore. Sure, he drove me to work here and there at 6 a.m. on my weekend shifts, but I expected him to punch me out when he found out about the stereo, and he didn't. You're just like your dad, he said instead. One lunch period near the end of school, I wandered over to the Chinese market on the other side of the parking lot where they kept the school buses during the day. I noticed a group of kids out back huddled behind a dumpster, so I decided to check it out. Balpreet was there, a tough Sikh kid we called Balpeen because he hit like a ballpeen hammer. I'd known him since grade 3. He stood in the middle of everyone holding a bottle full of smoke with a backwards cigarette sticking out of the bottom. He called me over and everyone shifted to make room for me. Indian, Balpreet said. You ever smoke hash before? He held the bottle up in my direction. No, I said, never. I looked closer and saw a little brown stone cooking on the end of the cigarette in the bottle. Smoke circled round and round within it and left a cream-colored stain on the clear plastic side. I thought of Irish coffee. Balpreet uncorked the lid, pulled the cigarette out, then thrust the full bottle of smoke in my face. Suck and hold, he said. A wisp of smoke floated under the bill of his Blue Jays hat. It smelt like burnt earth. I put the open nozzle to my mouth and sucked as directed. The smoke shot into my lungs. Raunchy. I almost coughed it out, but I held it for about a minute until my ribs convulsed and I dropped my cigarette. Then I spewed a plume of gray air up into the clouds. It was too thin to call it smoke. Still no coughing. A feeling of euphoria hit me, and then I wobbled and leaned on the dumpster. Balpreet said something in Punjabi and laughed. I noticed there was a line of tiny hash balls strewn out on the edge of the dumpster. He cracked a sideways smile and dabbed a cigarette on the next toke, then slid it in the bottle. He reminded me of Clint Eastwood after he'd gunned someone down. I broke out in laughter. That was my first encounter with drugs. The next week, I was buying a gram of hash from a friend behind the pizza place across the street from the school when squad cars rolled up. My friend, who had a leg in a cast, crushed the dope on the ground with the end of his crutch, and it stuck to the bottom of the rubber tip. The cops searched everywhere, on the roof, in the garbage cans, in our mouths, but couldn't figure out what we'd done with the drugs. We know you have some, one cop yelled. We saw the transaction. We emerged with only a warning, and my reputation was solidified. Older kids, and not just the ones I already hung out with, began showing me respect. A few months later, I was selling acid by the sheet and sniffing speed in the washroom before class every day.
The Strongest Brother. Jerry made a choker out of chicken bones and wooden colored beads. He was a creative guy and drew things like dragons and elves and played Dungeons and Dragons with his nerd friends at his new high school, an art school way out in the country. For as long as I could remember, too, he'd been proud of what he called native and found creative ways to express it. I made fun of him and his friends, but secretly played D&D with them and always had a blast. They were genuine in a way that my cool friends weren't. Look, he said with a big smile. Isn't it beautiful? The bone necklace was kind of all right. I thought it made him look strong and proud. It's last night's dinner, I said, deadpan. Why do you always do that, Jesse? Why do you shit on our heritage like that? I knew he was being sincere. He remembered more of Saskatchewan than I did, and had recently gone on a school trip near Regina and learned stuff about our mother's people and started making pipes out of soapstone, burning herbs, and wearing beads out in public. He started lifting weights after that, taking care of his health, and I even heard a drum bump ever so softly in his room sometimes. He said he was singing Indian songs. I didn't care. I stole the tobacco he got out west, not concerned about what ceremonial Indian uses he had for it. Heritage be damned. I just wanted to smoke. I looked at him and the necklace. Because it looks awful. Why do you and Josh play Indians? Fuck, we're from Brampton and never practiced that stuff. It's embarrassing. Jerry quietly asked me to leave his bedroom and shut the door as I left. I heard his drum that night, and the next day he wore his choker to school. I was jealous of Josh when we were little, and I was jealous of Jerry now.